This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Our Master Cheesemaker program is one of the only two in the world. So it's no wonder every master in America has called Wisconsin home. Find your next favorite cheese and meet our makers at wisconsincheese.com.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And today, we're talking about a little known and largely forgotten fact of culinary history. And that is that in the 19th century, Americans consumed a lot of tea. And the tea they favored was green tea, mostly consumed hot with milk and sugar. Who knew? We thought this was our new, you know, elegant Chinese venture with our sushi or before and after this green tea and now the health benefits of green tea. Well, little did we know Americans have been doing this for a long time. The teas that they used were imported from China until Japan developed an export industry centered on the United States. My guest today, historian and author Robert Hellyer, explores the forgotten American preference of green tea and traces the trans-Pacific tea trade from the 18th century forward in his new book, Green with Milk and Sugar. He shares his insights on how the interconnections between Japan and the United States have influenced the daily habits of people in both countries. Robert Hellyer is Associate Professor of History at Wake Forest University and no stranger to Japanese history. He is the author of Defining Engagement, Japan and Global Contexts from 1640 to 1868, and co-editor of The Meiji Restoration, Japan as a Global Nation in 2020. Robert, you've been very busy with your books because you just came out with this book. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Am I saying your name correctly, Hellyer?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Great. All right. So looking at your background, I see, as I said, that you're no stranger to Japanese culture, Japanese history. Tell me a little bit about your personal connection with this particular topic, green tea, and how you came to write this book.
Well, thank you again for inviting me to talk with you today. My personal connection particularly came through my grandmother's. I was fortunate. I grew up in Tacoma, Washington, which is near Seattle. And I was able to spend a lot of time with my grandmothers, both who lived quite near me. And my paternal grandmother, she grew up in a suburb of Chicago and moved to Tacoma soon after she was married. But before that, she had gone, actually as a newlywed, with my grandfather to Japan. Because at the time, my grandfather was working in the family company, Hellyer & Company, which was a tea export firm based in the city of Shizuoka, which is near Mount Fuji. And this was a very formative time for my grandmother, and she had all kinds of items she brought back from Japan and many stories that she shared with me. And so that was one impetus that got me interested to learn more about the trade. But also, my maternal grandmother was from a rural Illinois, and she had particular sensibilities about the types of foods that she would like. For example, garlic and pizza was something she would not touch. Those were foreign foods. But she kept a stash of green tea, which I was not allowed to drink. It was saved for guests as a more sophisticated beverage. And I was always intrigued. It stuck in my mind growing up. Why did my grandmother like green tea? And so to learn more about the stories of my grandmothers, I was one of the reasons, the motivations for writing this book.
Interesting. And obviously, the tea industry being in your background, I mean, that's pretty evident. And you did exploration in that same time period in your first book. What can you kind of back up and give us a little background of tea consumption in Japan?
Sure. Tea consumption, you can see it really starting in medieval Japan. The Heian period is often described as a wonderful time of of the flowering of court culture and things. This is from the late 8th century until the 12th century. And during that time, and even a little bit before that, Japan was embracing Chinese culture. China was the center of civilization. It was powerful. And Japanese wanted to do what the Chinese were doing. So one of the things involved with that was drinking tea. And this is talking about elites at the court who would drink tea. And as the Chinese would do, would also compose poetry and were overwhelmed by what tea would do to the body and the experiences you could have from it. But as with the case of the history of so many foods and beverages, that you start to see then a transition from the elite exotic product to a medicinal product. And that was a period also in Japan where tea was discovered, if you will, because of its medicinal value. There's a story about a shogun who was the generalissimo who, to cure a hangover, drank a cup of green tea and was overwhelmed by how much better he felt. And so this was one of the ways of which tea started to begin to become more widely consumed in Japan. It was also then grown in Japan. And so by Japan's last feudal age, the Edo period from 1600 to 1868, tea was consumed by all classes on an everyday basis. So the progression in the history of tea in Japan is something that we can trace and connect to the history of Japan overall.
Right. And that period, the Edo period, so much of their, you know, their cultural habits were established during that period. I mean, that was a very important time.
Yes.
At least from a culinary standpoint, you know, I see that.
Certainly.
Yeah. Well, the Japanese were still, they were basically, you mentioned in your book, relying on Chinese expertise with helping them in their production and their growing of tea. This went on for some time, did it not?
Right. Well, that's the transition, the important part of, I mentioned a moment ago, the Meiji Restoration, which was when the Tokugawa, it was a military, a samurai government was overthrown. And the samurai who took control of government said that we need to change Japan. We need to adopt more of Western institutions. And particularly, we need to switch Japan's economy to a path that hopefully we can move to industrialization. And one of the ideas and one of the policies they adopted was to promote exports or goods that had not been exported before by Japan. And notably, silk and tea and coal were the three biggest exports. Hmm. So to develop the export trade, I mean, Japanese had been throughout the Edo period before cultivating tea, consuming it in the domestic market. But to develop an export trade, they needed the Chinese know-how. And that's where the really fundamental role of Chinese experts came in, down to where that you would have the factory. It was modeled, the refining factory where the tea was placed in pans to eliminate the moisture before it was exported. Mm-hmm. That process was based upon Chinese practices. And so the factories that were built in Japan to export tea were very much modeled on what was done in China, what had been done in China for previous centuries.
Hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about this American preference for the green tea. Americans, being, you know, settled by the English, didn't start out liking green teas and drinking green tea mostly. It was black tea. It was, you know, I would imagine the tea of colonized India and China that they were drinking. So what happened? How did that come about?
Well, as you mentioned, during colonial times, Americans were drinking tea much in the same way as Britons. And that was green and black tea. But after 1800, a really interesting thing happened that Americans start to develop a preference for green tea. And I never found sort of one trigger as to why this change took place. But I think one of the answers is that the British and a lot of the tea exported from Canton in southern China, which is the at that time the only port where Westerners could obtain tea. A lot of the contracts that the English East India Company had were for black tea. And so a lot of the black tea that was from Canton was going to Britain. Therefore, what was left over was green tea. And American merchant ships that were going to Canton were loading cargoes of green tea, and they found that they could sell it in the United States for higher prices. So when you have this develop where the merchants realize that they're going to take the green tea and get more from it, they keep bringing more green tea. And it's very interesting, too, that green tea started to have an aura of sophistication after roughly 1800. And I have a reference in my book about a newspaper article that I found from the Trenton Federalist in about 1803. And it was lambasting President Thomas Jefferson for his high ways of living, riding around in coaches and drinking green tea with sugar added in it. And while the rest of the everyday Americans were only had molasses or anything like that. So there's sort of locked in after that the connection of a sophistication of green tea in the American experience, which I think continues well into the 20th century.
Well, and then this preference, as you mentioned in the title of your book, with milk and sugar, that's rather surprising. In black tea, of course, a little spot of milk or cream a la British isn't surprising, but rarely do you see that, I guess, with the green teas. That struck me, obviously. You too, because you use it
right.
as a title.
yes, it was an intriguing element, and I think to present what American tastes at the time throughout the 19th and 20th century and into today are very individual. American tea culture never developed something like, for example, chai, which is developed in India from the 1960s, where if you're ordering tea, it's understood that you're going to get it with milk and maybe some additives to it. But there was never that sort of American way, prescribed American way of tea consumption that developed. So therefore, there was quite a variety and a lot of people adding milk and sugar to green tea.
Right. And you mentioned, the criticisms of Jefferson and his so-called elite ways. Well, tea itself was looked upon as sort of that very elite, if not even effeminate kind of preferred drink, you know, with the little pinky sticking out and sipping
right.
tea in the afternoon. And yet, from what you have uncovered and offered in your book here is that this wave of drinking the green tea, possibly hot with milk and sugar, you know, was a wave that took over in America and predominantly in or largely in the Midwest.
Yes.
Okay, talk about that one.
Oh, sure. I mean, we have actually from the 1850s or so, there's a really interesting variations, regional variations of tea consumption that green tea still dominates, but Americans are also starting to drink oolong tea from Taiwan, and oolong particularly became popular in New England. And so we get into the 1870s and 1880s. This, is, of course, is a time of incredible economic surge in the Midwest. I mean, the cities that are sprouting from the prairie, Chicago being the most important, but also other cities throughout the Midwest. And so what I've concluded with this is at this time that Midwesterners want to be inheritors of what is the sophisticated American tea culture, which is green tea. And so green tea continues to really have a niche in the Midwest that continues really until the 1930s.
Interesting. Well, this new interest in green tea and teas and more tea in general really had quite an effect on the Japanese agricultural production and the growing of tea. What were some of those effects? Can you talk about that? What the trade did for them?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, as I mentioned, the Meiji Restoration in a period of important transition, and many parts of Japan, some that had been growing tea for centuries, others that tea had not been an important product, mobilized to plant more tea and ship it to these ports, Yokohama or Nagasaki being the most important one, that'd be exported to the U.S. Tea was then seen as a way to revitalize in many cases, these different regions. And so we see a tremendous increase in the amount of tea grown in Japan. Of course, as I mentioned, tea had been grown for centuries, but never to the level that we see developing in the late 19th and continuing into the 20th century. So the fact that there's so much more tea grown in Japan today is a legacy in many ways of this American demand from the 19th century.
Hmm. And weren't some, of course, I guess maybe that was later on, you talk about the St. Louis connection or whatever, that some tea was, some farmers began to grow tea, had small tea plantations in the U.S.?
Oh, in the U.S.? Yes, there was an attempt in the 19th century. There was actually a government agency right before the Civil War was hoping to begin tea cultivation in parts of the U.S. that never took off, of course, because of the Civil War. But after that, there were pockets of production, most prominently in South Carolina, in Pinehurst. But these were never that viable because there was so much tea being grown in other parts of the world, in Asia, and this tea could be imported at a very low price, and it was of good quality. So therefore, the American industry never really took off. There were attempts to do it in the 19th century, and there's still a plantation near Charleston, for example. Hmm.
So Pinehurst, they probably just turned those tea plantations into the golf course, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's great. Well, this is very interesting, and I have some other curiosities that I want to get to. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. In Wisconsin, cheese is our thing. Wisconsin is the only state in the country that requires a license to make cheese. From curds to cheddar, blue to brick, Wisconsin cheesemakers can do it all. We blend tradition with innovation to create an incredible variety of cheeses that you just can't get anywhere else. You've heard of a PhD, but have you heard of a PH cheese? Otherwise known as the Wisconsin Master Cheesemaker Program. This rigorous study of cheese is an elite accomplishment earned by only 80 talented cheesemakers in Wisconsin, and the program is only one of two in the world. Becoming a master cheesemaker takes 13 years and is basically like a doctorate in a specific variety of cheese, with intense requirements to succeed. Our Master Cheesemaker Program allows makers to perfect both the art and science of their craft in a tradition so rich you can taste it. Find your next favorite cheese and meet our makers at wisconsincheese.com.
Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Robert Hellyer about America's love of green tea and then as tea in general, as it turns out. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned, Robert, how tea, kind of people were drinking this green tea. When this could have been the Japanese, this could have been, you know, the Chinese, but and also the Americans. I did read that in your book too, that they liked the feeling they were getting from it in their clear heads. You talked about perhaps, you know, as a cure for a hangover, but not unlike today's kind of wave or movement with the coffee houses for a lot of young people who decided to perhaps abstain from alcoholic beverages for a while, and they focus on coffee. I mean, it just seems to, everything kind of goes in waves.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. One thing that I have had a question that you mentioned earlier, and that was the production, if you will, or the methods for getting the tea ready for market, and that is that it's, you know, dried out. Or you had mentioned something in that I read that it was fired tea. What can you talk about? What so that this is basically, you know, about the tea and its preparation, particularly.
Sure. Yes, you're referring to the period before mechanization really took off for the tea industry in Japan in the early 20th century. But before that, and when the first exports are going to the United States, for example, from the 1860s and 1870s, the process for refining the tea was based upon Chinese practices. And the most prominent of these was to have a factory that had rows of pans, and underneath it were fires that were kept going. And in the pans would be placed tea that had been quickly steamed after it was picked to stop the oxidization process, but it needed to be put under more intense heat to remove all the moisture. Otherwise, when it was packed in a chest and put on for a fairly long journey to the United States, the chest would be open and be moldy. So this process of, we have, and have images in the book, for example, of these factories of which the workers were predominantly women, who would be working in these pans. It would have been very difficult work, hard work, particularly in the summer, you know, over 100 degrees, but stirring the tea for upwards of 30 to 40 minutes to remove the moisture from it. And then it would be packed either into small packets or into large tea chests and sent to the United States. But there were the pan-fired methods, and also another method where there was charcoal underneath, but it was a basket that was used to fire the tea. And I mention these because Americans chose their green tea, their Japanese green tea, based upon whether it was either pan or basket fired. A group of Japanese tea merchants who went to survey the American market in the 1890s, intriguingly would talk about, so for example, people in Omaha, Nebraska liked pan-fired tea, but people in Minnesota preferred the basket-fired tea. So it's really interesting the way that Americans had particular tastes in their types of green tea they consumed.
Huh, interesting. That's very interesting. Is there one type in Japan, let's say, that's considered more authentic than another?
Well, I don't know about authentic, but there was, and one of the things that I do talk about in my book is that when Japan started to export tea, you had a type of green tea, sencha, which is the most prominent and popular and well-known green tea from Japan today, that was consumed in cities. But by and large, people in rural areas would consume a different type of green tea called bancha. And bancha is picked, most sencha is picked in April or May when you have the fresh buds. And that's the best tea, the best quality tea. But bancha is picked throughout the year, and it includes, you know, older, coarser leaves and stems as well. And most Japanese at this time who were living in rural areas would grow their own tea and create their own bancha and have it at home. And so this was one of the ways of which Japanese were drinking a green tea. But actually, what's intriguing about bancha is that when it's brewed, it is brown. And so one of the points that I want to make about the book is we have roughly in 1850, tea in Japan was a brown tea for most people. But in the United States, Americans wanted it green to the point that Japanese and Chinese would add coloring agents, notably Prussian blue, which was, as the name implies, it was created in Prussia in the 18th century to dye Prussian military uniforms. This was added first in Canton in the late 18th century to tea to make it green. And Americans knew that it was colored, would purchase it because they wanted to see a green tea at the market. This is one of the intriguing things that I found too, that people are American consumers in a lot of cases would be choosing their tea not so much maybe on the flavor, but how it looked at the market. was a big determining factor.
Not surprising, considering people, you know, have a hard time with maybe organic fruits and vegetables that are a little ugly,
right,
and as opposed to those that are grown in controlled environments, right? And that's interesting. But the brown, yeah, but you figure if they're drying it, in order for shipping, it would turn a little brown.
Right? Yes, it was the descriptions, it would be white or gray. And I found a couple references to people who would see the uncolored tea versus the colored tea and say, oh, the colored tea is the one I want. This was certainly an important part of tea consumption in the late 19th and into some parts of the 20th century.
Well, I mean, tea was not that popular, I would imagine. I mean, I'm sure popular, but where did Americans, let's say I'm going to the grocery store for my goods or not, well, we didn't have grocery stores until the early 20th century, but I'm going to the market, mm-hmm. going to the markets. Where did one purchase their teas?
Well, I would say in the early 19th century that you would go to, I guess, would be your grocer, right? And maybe I could explain, I think, the process that continued throughout the 19th century, that you would go to whoever is this grocer or salesperson and just ask for a certain amount of tea that would mm-hmm. be put into a package. And as the 19th century developed, particularly the tea exporters and the importers would make packages that would have the name of that small grocer. So the small grocer in somewhere in Minnesota, his grocer would have his own brand name of tea that he would be selling. And so as I understand it, that you would go, as I said, and ask for that certain amount, and that would be put into the bag. So that was probably the most prominent way. But from 1860, you have the AMP, the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company,
right.
Very famous.
Right.
This starts to innovate by selling a lot more through mail orders. And they find it very lucrative, and the AMP is very good about presenting their teas as being directly imported. Actually, they probably weren't. They were going through wholesalers. But nonetheless, people liked this new system and also encouraged to get together in a club and buy tea together for a savings, a discount on that. So that was another addition from the 1860s and 1870s. And then toward the end of the 19th century, you had a lot more of the companies that were delivering tea as the wagon delivery that would go circuit, once a week, that would come by with various items, but one that I profiled in my book was Jewel Tea Company, mm-hmm. Which had these wagons that would go around parts of the Midwest, and they had their own brands of tea, of a Japanese green tea or a different Chinese tea that they would, their house brands that they would sell as well. So those mm-hmm. were some of the ways that Americans were getting their teas.
Yeah, and when I saw that, I wondered if, I mean, there's a very popular chain of grocery stores throughout the Midwest called Jewel, the Jewel grocery stores.
Jewel Osco, yes. They originate from Jewel Tea Company.
Yeah, that's what that was my question. I wondered about that. Of course,
yes.
We know the story of AMP as well.
Right, right.
Yeah. So look at it. It was a springboard and a birth of, larger business for sure. Let's talk about some of these cultural and social trends that kind of were shared or differed from the Japanese society to the American. I mean, the Japanese society greatly influenced the U.S. as to, what we were drinking. What about mm-hmm. some other trends and going backwards the other way? Is there anything that you can pinpoint that stands out?
Oh, you mean trends in Japanese versus American consumption, or?
Yeah, I guess that would be it. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, one thing that
affected them or them us.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Well, as I mentioned in the case of Japan, that going back in around 1850 that people were consuming the bancha. And this was the tea that was grown at home, if you will. But in around 1920, we see that Americans start to turn towards black tea. And this, to me, is a combination of the negative, often racially charged advertising that was used by Indian Ceylon producers, a slightly lower price, and then also much more wider advertising by these large firms. That it's pretty clear that Americans in the early 1920s are turning to black teas. Now, for the Japanese producers, this caused a real problem. Not only they've lost this lucrative export market, but right before that, during World War I, Japan had had record amounts of production of tea. So what will you do with the tea? We see in the 1920s, for really the first time, the Japan Tea Association, other groups focusing on the Japanese domestic market and wanting to sell sencha, this type of green tea that had been exported predominantly to the United States. And to me, this is where one of the takeaways from the book is how much the 1920s and 1930s are turning points for tea in the United States and Japan, because we start to see sencha becoming a more dominant type of tea in Japan. And that trend continues to this day, as is the case with black tea consumption being dominant in the United States today.
Right, right. And our, of course, then a lot of, you know, political problems ensued in First World War, Second World War particularly. I'm sure that shut down Japanese tea drinking for us, and our markets changed, correct?
Yes, that was, it was starting to decline, as the points that I made just a moment ago. Mm-hmm. But the outbreak of war in 1941 ended the export trade, and it never recovered in the post-war period. There were hopeful signs that maybe Americans would want to drink green tea again, but it never recovered. And Japan started to export. It wasn't on the same level as the exports to the U.S. in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, but export was significant to North Africa. At that time, areas, for example, Algeria, that was then under French occupation. But in the case of Japan, most of the tea that was produced was being sold and consumed within Japan.
All right. Interesting. Well, you, back to your great, was it your great, great grandfather who was in the tea industry?
Yes.
Okay. So tell us a little bit more about how that came about, what you know, at least as much as you know. I mean, that was interesting to get into that business from coming from the Midwest, or he came from Washington, the West.
No, he came from Britain, actually. So
that's right. The English side of the
yes,
family.
Yes. The first of my, going back roughly five generations, my uncle, his name was William Ault. He left Britain when he was 14. He became, working on a ship that was trading throughout the world. And he arrived, he was on the ship for about 5 years, and he ended up taking an offer to work as a merchant in Shanghai. He did that for a bit, and then he heard about the opportunities in Japan. That was from 1859, Japan adopted, under Western pressure, the treaty port regime, which had been established in China after the Opium War. And so a place like Nagasaki was going to have the opportunity for Western traders to be there and trade in a way that they couldn't do during the Edo period. So William Ault went to Nagasaki and started trading in anything he could be involved with. He would get ships, for example, and sell them to Japanese lords. But he also started to export tea. And he, like other merchants, saw that the American market was a perfect place for Japanese green tea to be exported. And so he continued in the company. He was very driven, and he was able to have a dream, which I think many of us have, that he retired at 32 and returned to Britain and also bought a villa on the Italian coast. So he did very well for himself. And he turned the company over to my great-great-grandfather, Frederick Hellyer, who then took over the company and renamed it Hellyer & Company. And Frederick had also been born in Britain, but spent a lot of time in Japan, and then decided, because of the importance of the Midwest and that market for his company and its tea exports, to move to Chicago in 1888. And so that's why on my father's side, my family became Americans. It was because of the exports of Japanese green tea.
Huh. Interesting. Interesting story. Everyone has an interesting story. That's what that yes. one is particularly yes. interesting. Which came first, your interest in history and the global trading and development of Japan, or because of your family history?
Well, the family history.
Personal, I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's fine. The family history came first because I mentioned as a boy that I had both the exposure in a sense of the export side of this story from my grandmother and that side of the my paternal grandmother. But then my maternal grandmother also, I realized that it was the wonderful story of the consumption side, of the fact that here was somebody living in rural Illinois who was embracing and enjoying green tea. So that's really got me a sense of why I wanted to do this project. But then also as a historian, seeing all the really interesting global angles and perspectives that can be brought into this. For example, one that we talked about earlier, the fact of how Chinese experts played such a big role in allowing Japan to export tea to the U.S.
Right. I mean, it maps out so many different influences and developments over the time, which is what I love about looking at, history through the lens of one particular item, and for me, a culinary item, a food or dining habit. And this certainly does that. It certainly tells a tale, a very interesting tale. And I thank you for focusing on this, focusing on the green tea with milk and sugar, and that green with milk and sugar. Who knew? I mean, that now when we, request our special green teas and our, of course, the matcha, ceremonies and fancy drinks, and it just it's puts a whole new perspective on it when I think of it. I thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Right, and good luck with this book. I think it's a fascinating book that I think people, it's what is wonderful is you have terrific footnotes and a great index and bibliography. But the story is very readable. It's also just a story. So, for those who want to just have an interesting story on, how a particular product influences our world, that certainly does it.
And well, thank you. I'm heartened to hear that, because that's what I hope to have as an academic, giving the footnotes and things like that, but also hopefully that a story that those who might not be as inclined to pick up a book written by an academic might pick this up. So
well, hey, listen, the choice of whoever did the choice of the cover was that was a surefire winner. And again, for my listeners, the book is called Green with Milk and Sugar: When Japan Filled Americans' Teacups. And again, my guest and author, it's Robert Hellyer. And the publisher is Columbia University Press. And yes, it is interesting. And I encourage people to take a look. And thank you again for joining me.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening. Once again, this has been A Taste of the Past. And I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on Heritage Radio Network. And if you're listening through Heritage Radio Network, you can listen to this anywhere you get your podcasts. But if you go to our website, heritageradionetwork.org, you'll see a beating heart in the upper right-hand corner. And in order to keep our voices on the air, you might consider giving a little love to the Heritage Radio Network website. We are a network of about 35 to 40 food shows that are interesting from all aspects of food and, as you heard, history. So tune in again. Thank you.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.